is Macro Voices with hedge fund manager Eric Townsend, the free weekly financial podcast targeting professional finance, high net worth individuals, family offices, and other sophisticated investors. Macro Voices is all about the brightest minds in the world of finance and macroeconomics telling it like it is, bullish or bearish, no holds barred. Now, here are your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Serezna.
Macro Voices episode 56 was recorded on March 30th, 2017. I'm Eric Townsend. We're bringing back one of our most popular guests ever this week. Macro Intelligence 2 Partners founder Julian Brigden will be joining me as our feature interview guest. Now, for any new listeners who aren't familiar with Julian, he is Mr. Graphs and Charts, and he always sends us a fantastic book of charts and graphs to support the interview. This week, of course, is no exception. So I strongly recommend that you download the chart book before the interview begins. Registered users at macrovoices.com already receive the download link in your Research Roundup email. If you're not yet registered, you can find instructions for how to register and download the handout in the description of this interview next to Julian Brigden's photo on our homepage at macrovoices.com.
And I'm Patrick Serezna. Eric, that S&P 500 started Monday looking like the selling was just going to resume, and then suddenly we get this reversal and we've been rallying all week. What's your feeling on the S&P here?
Well, yeah, you know, it looked like the Trump euphoria was wearing off. But as I've been saying for a few weeks now, you know, people keep calling a top. And I say it's a little early cyclically for that to be happening. And besides, calling tops and bottoms is tricky business and usually foolhardy to start with. Most professional traders will tell you you're better off to wait until a trend is clearly established. And the only trend that we've got now is this very, very strong uptrend in equities. And I think maybe it's showing signs that it's starting to break. And I think that before the year is out, it's going to reverse to the downside. If we do move to new highs, I'm not going to go short. I might start to think about a strategy for accumulating out of the money puts, because I do think this is all going to reverse at some point. But to try to call the day that the top is in and put a big short on, to me, that's just asking for trouble. That's the reason I've stayed away from it.
And that reversal in the U.S. dollar seemed to happen literally at the same time as the stock market low. We started off the week just at the downtick on the dollar index, down in the 98 handle area. And then suddenly we find ourselves over the $100 level. What's your feeling on the dollar index here?
Well, I got stopped out of that trade, fortunately or unfortunately, as the case may be, on that move below 99, a 98 spot 74 was my stop, which got hit. And I was thinking of you, actually, Patrick, because, of course, what's happened now is we've moved back to a 100 handle. So far, at least, it would appear that I got whipsawed out and basically covered at the low, and now maybe it all takes off and my bullish call was right, and I don't get to participate. The reason I say it made me think of you is, had I hedged that risk with a put option rather than a stop loss order, I'd still be in the trade and only out a little bit of money for the premium on that option. So it makes a good argument for hedging with options. But you know what? I'm still going to wait this one out. As much as it looks like what happened is I got stopped out right at the bottom and it's reversed, you know, we're seeing a lot of froth here. I was expecting the dollar rally to have resumed in earnest by now. It didn't play out the way I expected it to. I got stopped out. It's kind of a matter of discipline. I'm going to sit out a couple of dances and see what happens here before I consider re-entering that trade.
Now, after we had that weakness in crude oil perpetuating some very oversold conditions, we finally get this bounce. We're back above the $50 level. What's your feelings on oil here?
Well, based on fundamental analysis, I still think that we should be headed back towards 45 unless there's some new data that would change my view, if not lower. But you remember last week I said the technicals are starting to look like something's going on. We saw that reversal candle that seemed to be invalidated. But then after we taped last week's show coming into the beginning of this week, we saw a couple of really firm rejections of that round number support at $47 on the front month contract. And moving up from there, we were just teetering on the 200-day moving average. And I'm referring, of course, to the 200-day moving average on the nearest futures chart, not on the May 17 futures chart where it appears much higher. My contention is that for moving averages, you really care about what the front month price looked like, and what was going on in the May contract 6 months ago or 9 months ago is not really relevant. What was going on in the front month at the time is the information you get from a moving average drawn on the nearest futures contract. So that one is around 48.65 or so. Now we were just teetering on that, and then inventory came out Wednesday. We did see a build in crude oil inventories again. 867,000 barrels, though, was quite a bit less than the 2 million barrel expectation. Cushing, Oklahoma, saw a drawdown of 220,000 barrels. So a very small drawdown, but a drawdown just the same. Now, I still think based on those numbers alone, the crude oil picture is continuing to go the way that I have been predicting that it would. We're seeing builds and net on inventory. We moved to a new all-time high in total national crude oil inventory this week. Even though it was a fairly modest build, it still took us to another all-time high. And Cushing, if it had gone the other way by 220,000 barrels, would have taken us to an all-time high in Cushing, Oklahoma inventory. The thing was, massive and much bigger than expected drawdowns in finished products. Gasoline drawing down 3.7 million barrels. Distillates drawing down 2.5 million barrels. Both of those figures were about double analysts' expectations. That signal of increasing demand or solid demand appears to be what's responsible for this big bounce up that we've seen in prices. And once again, our friends at hashtag OOTT and tankertrackers.com called the build. They expected a small build. That's what we got. So I don't think that this is really all that bullish. I think that what's going on here is we did not see another humongous, ginormous 5 million barrel build like we had last week. That was a sigh of relief. That combined with the very strong drawdowns in finished products maybe caused traders to take their eye off the ball and not notice that production turned up again. And I'll tell you something, folks, it's going to continue to turn up because it's very, very easy when we have a period as we do now of rapidly increasing rig count. All you have to do is lag that rig count chart by about 6 months and you can very accurately predict what's going to happen to U.S. production. And the answer is it's going to keep going up at the same trajectory that it's been going up. And these increases in U.S. production from the restart of the shale revolution are going to overcome and outdo anything that happens from OPEC. So now we're well above that 200-day moving average. Looks to me like 50, 51 is probably the range, and that's about where we are as we're speaking on Thursday afternoon. Somewhere between 50 and 51 is where I think this bounce will top out. I still expect that we're going to pivot and revert back and probably at least retest that $47 number. I think we'll break through it next time and get down to a 45 handle. Of course, that could change if the fundamentals change. I think what we need at this point is we'll probably wait out this week because we had modestly bullish data if you weren't paying attention to the production ticking up. I think if we get a big build, another 5 million barrel build on inventory next week, that'll be the catalyst to cause an accelerated move to the downside. But for now, we're in a bounce.
Now, Eric, before we move on from oil, I know on Twitter you got hit up with a question that you couldn't answer. Did you want to share that with our listeners?
Well, what are you talking about? I answered it right away. I said, I don't know. So here's my answer. But I really hope somebody does know, because it was a fantastic question. It has to do with the participants in the storage. We're talking about Cushing, Oklahoma, teetering on the edge of all-time record-high amounts of oil in storage. So the question you have to ask yourself is, you know that some of the people that are active in this market are what I call the contango yield storage crowd. These are people who have access to the physical tanks. And what they do is they're long some number of thousands of barrels of physical crude oil that's in a tank. They're short an equal number of futures contracts. So they have no market risk. They're not taking any risk with respect to the price of oil going up or down because the futures and the physical cancel each other out. The thing is, when there's contango in the market, when each successive monthly price is higher than the price before, those guys that have the oil in storage are rolling their positions forward, and they capture that contango as a profit every single month. And we've had pretty steep contango, especially at the front of the curve where they're making their money. The question that was asked of me is, how do you measure of these 500 million barrels or whatever it is that's in storage in Cushing, Oklahoma, how many of those barrels are controlled by these guys who are playing this game versus how many of them are just owned by, you know, refineries, people that need them to run their business? And I thought about that. I thought, boy, I really, really want to know the answer to that question, because you can translate that to some very tradable strategies. If you know how much of the oil, let's say half of the oil in Cushing, Oklahoma, is controlled by people who are doing that, you know that that contango has to stay in the front of the curve, because as soon as it starts to come out, those guys just say, hey, I'm not going to roll my position forward. I'll just deliver into that contract and you can keep the oil. And the longs say, wait a minute. I'm just a speculator. I don't have a tank to put it in. And they say, you darn right you don't have a tank to put it in. And that's why you're going to give me a deep discount when you buy from me in order to roll your long position forward and I move my short position forward. Now, if those guys were just 1% of the market, they wouldn't have any influence and they'd just get run over by what happens. So if you knew how many of them there were and how much of Cushing storage were controlled by those guys, it would be a huge edge in terms of trading advantage. I don't know how to figure that out. I've talked to a couple of people, including a merchant trader, who said the only way you can really get to that is to try to deduce it from, if you could find out, say, a given company, you know, from its public documents, has a lease on X number of barrels. Okay, you know they've got that, and you know how much total is there. How much can you account for and figure out who it is and how much is left over? And you're still taking guesses. That's the best I can do, but I would love to hear from some of the experts in our audience if there is a way to better gauge how many people are engaged in that contango yield trade.
Well, thanks, Eric. And so let's actually move on to gold. I want to get your opinion on this. Back in February, we tested this 1260 level. And once again, we find ourselves earlier in the week having tested and rejected off that level. Is this where the highs of gold come in, or do you think that we're going to get a breakout here?
Well, I think the big question is the dollar index. It looked like the dollar index was starting to break down below its key support, and it looked like gold was really taking off. And now we're seeing that the dollar index is bouncing and gold is not holding on as well as it was earlier. It really depends, I think, on the direction of the dollar. I'm not going to make any calls on either one. I'm going to take a sideline position. I am regretting not buying that 1125 bottom that I actually predicted myself, and then my view had changed by the time it happened. But I would like to start accumulating gold as a long-term position. I was very much affected by Jeff Christian's outlook last week, and I'll be looking to buy the dips, but I'm not sure that we're there yet.
All right. Well, now, when we look at that 10-year treasury yield, obviously going into the Fed meeting, we were hovering around that 2.6 level. We saw about 20-point drop down to about this 2.4 level on yields. What's your feeling about interest rates here?
Well, this is an area that Julian Brigden focuses on a lot, so I really want to get his take on this. My feeling is, you know, we're in a correction here. I'm not sure. Is it that the secular bear market in treasuries has begun, but we're in a correction that's countercyclical to that? Or is it that the last leg of the bull market isn't quite over yet? I'm not sure, but it feels like we're in a correction where bond yields are coming back down, bond prices are going back up. I want to eventually be on the short side of this trade, short the bonds, anticipating higher yields, but now is not the time to get into that one. So I want to ask Julian Brigden when will be the time and what signals he'll be looking for.
All right. Well, thanks for that market update there, Eric. Now, Julian Brigden is the founder of Macro Intelligence 2 Partners and is a highly respected macro analyst known for his detailed graphs and charts. Now, if you are not yet registered, the instructions to get the download of the chart book is on the macrovoices.com website in the description of the podcast next to Julian's picture. Now, so Eric's interview with Mr. Brigden is coming up as Macro Voices continues right here at Macro Voices.
And now, with this week's special guest, here's hedge fund manager Eric Townsend.
Joining me next on the program is Julian Brigden, founder of Macro Intelligence 2 Partners. Julian, of course, has been one of our most favorite guests, and you absolutely want the chart deck that accompanies this interview. We told you earlier in the program where you can find the download. Julian, why don't we go ahead and jump right into the book of charts that you sent us. This first one is talking about the U.S. dollar and the effect, the knock-on effect on the shale bubble. So let's talk about that connection.
Right, absolutely. So thanks very much for having me back on the show, Eric, first off. And let's sort of do a little bit of background before we kick off. So last time I was on in December, we discussed how this sort of pause that we had in the dollar starting in 2016 unleashed this very powerful cyclical effect. Obviously, we've all seen it in energy prices and how oil prices have percolated through into inflation. But I think what's also not quite as well understood is how that also manifests itself via that same sort of essentially base effect into the economic data, the growth data. And that is very simply because when we typically look, and this is something we talked about in December, when we typically look at growth data, we very rarely look at the level of growth. What we typically discuss is the speed or the acceleration of growth. And by that, I mean, you know, month on month, quarter on quarter, year on year. So if you look at the first slide in the pack, and what we've done is we've taken wholesale sales for a whole bunch of various different components in the economy, and you can see how the activity in the shale space influenced some of these series. Now, we think that to a large extent, you can explain some of the enormous growth divergences that we had between Europe and the United States, in particular in sort of 2012, 13, and 14, via this build out of what was essentially a brand new industry for the US. So then the dollar rally comes along starting in 2012 and accelerates, obviously, as we know, in 2014. And the Fed bursts their own bubble. The rig count absolutely collapses and implodes, and you see it drags down the rate of change of a number of those key wholesale industries. What's interesting, though, is that we've seen a bounce now. Now, in absolute terms, the rig count has risen reasonably substantially, about 25-26%. But when you look at the rate of change of that rig count, you can see it's up 80%. And the same applies to petrochemicals, and you're seeing some of the other stuff in some of these other metals and some of these other industries. And that's the point of this base effect. And the same thing manifests itself if you look at the next chart to a large extent when you look at something like PMIs. PMIs are also a measurement at the end of the day of rate of change and not of level. Now, I know lots of people, I'm sure you're very familiar with it, Eric, will say, oh, you know, much below 48 and we move into recession. And generally, that's sort of true. But the rate of change element you can see here in stark contrast, because you look at what happened in 2009. Remember, this was the depths of the GFC. Okay, the first half of the year growth was imploding. Second half of the year recovered somewhat. But essentially over the whole year, we got zero growth. And yet ISM went from the very low 30s up all the way to 60s. Why? Because essentially we were seeing the negative effect of 2008 dropout. We had this very powerful base effect. And so to a large extent, what we've seen is that in terms of some of these PMI data. And that's what we were playing all of last year. And what we said in December, we will come to a point where this thing will just naturally run its course. It just doesn't get any faster.
I don't think we've ever had ISM much over 60 in recent history, and certainly not on this chart. So
no, absolutely. You can take it back. You have to really take it back into the sort of really late 70s, early 80s, when the inventory cycle and the inventory control was far less polished than it is now. Now firms are much more smarter and quicker to adjust inventory, so you don't get these massive inventory swings. Inventory swings is one of the most vicious cycles, along with CapEx, that we get in the economy. But essentially, you're right, Eric, we don't get much higher. The model's suggesting that maybe we can punch out one further higher number, which I think comes out next week, and maybe we can clip a 60 on ISM manufacturing. But if you look at that, what you'll find is there's only been eight occasions since 1985 where we've been at or above 60. So, you know, and you're already starting to get some signs of disappointment in some of these PMIs. So if you look at, say, the Dallas Fed survey, which came out, I think, last week, the previous number had been 24.5. It was supposed to come in at 22, and it came in at 16.9. And all of this makes us believe that we are approaching not only the sort of cyclical high in terms of the inflation story, which we'll talk about in a second, but also the cyclical high in terms of the speed of the growth story. And that has important ramifications, I think, for markets. It's not super bearish. We're not trying to say that we think the US is going back into recession. We just think that the data is going to start to essentially disappoint.
So essentially, the way to interpret this is not, oh boy, 60, that's great. This is as good as it gets, and a mean reversion has to start soon.
Correct, sir. Absolutely. Absolutely. And we would see a drop, you know, probably into the mid to low 50s, which will still be commensurate with sort of 2.5% GDP growth. It's just going to take some of this froth and this exuberance out of the market. And you're going to see the same effect in inflation. Now, I do think there's a bigger story going on in inflation. I do think that a lot of these central bankers have discussed ad nauseum, and particularly the Europeans have been laying a lot of weight on the fact that, don't worry, this pickup in inflation is simply a base effect. Well, my argument would be the whole drop in inflation, and we've highlighted it in this chart, in 2014 into 2015, was also just an oil effect. So you can't suddenly, try and dismiss it when it's pushing pressure onto the top side and embrace it and ease like crazy, or don't tighten in the case of the Fed when you're looking at the drop in inflation. But once again, you can see from this chart here that we've got PCE following our model, following what firms are doing, raising prices. We think that PCE will probably punch up above 2.5% at its next print, but then it does settle down. What's interesting, though, is it doesn't drop back down anywhere close, none of the models suggesting anywhere close to the sort of lows of 2014, 2015. So we're going to settle, and I think, into a much more normal level of inflation, essentially the same sorts of level of inflation that we saw prior to oil's drop. And, and for central banks, that's going to create bigger problems. But that comes initially, we're going to get that peak. We're definitively going to get that peak.
So is your view then that we are at the beginning of a secular return of inflation, and that this is not just a passing thing, but maybe we've seen the first whiff and we're on a break? Help me understand the big picture of where we're headed.
Absolutely. That is, a lot, I think, depends on the Trump administration's ability to push through some sort of stimulus tax, infrastructure spending, which on balance, talking to contacts in D.C., we still believe is the most likely case, but really becomes a 2018 kind of scenario, Eric. It's really, we've seen now, I don't think anything that we've seen thus far has really got that much to do with Trump. I think maybe the final upleg in the equity market is Trump, and I think he certainly acted as an accelerant, but certainly in terms of the macro picture, the pickup in inflation, the pickup in the data is very simply the base effects which started to manifest itself all the way back in 2016. As soon as the dollar went on hold, you got the reflation in financial markets. So essentially what we're seeing is essentially that wave flow through from financial prices into real economic data. And that was going to happen whether Trump was in place or not. What Trump could do, though, is that now that we are sort of essentially normalizing inflation, despite these central banks in 2014, 2015 running around like Chicken Little, screaming that the sky was falling. I think the risk that what Trump will do, and we'll look at this, some of the sensitivities of this in a second, is he potentially, with fiscal spending in an economy which really on balance doesn't really need it. I mean, if you go back and look at history, big tax cuts by governments, you look at, say, Reagan's tax cuts in the 80s. Well, those came about at the time when Paul Volcker had crushed the US economy, really put the screws to the US consumer. And so we were almost on the edge of recession when we got those tax cuts. If you look at Bush's tax cuts, those were past the dot-com bust. So we were arguably in recession again. We're not in recession. We do not have rising unemployment. We have falling unemployment. And the risk is that you get a bout of, you know, big fiscal, big tax cuts that come through and push down that unemployment rate to levels which I think really could start to kick up inflation. But it's a cycle. And I think that's really a late 2017, early 2018 thing. And in the interim, we have this peaking of this cyclical forces. And, you know, we talked about how it would eventually get to this point in December when we were on your program. And now we're at essentially right at that tipping point. And I think you can already see in the bond market, the bond market is already, I think, beginning to interpret that. One of the other things, if you look at the next slide, is I think we also have to be cognizant that since Trump came to power and since last summer, there has been a material tightening of financial conditions. So, for example, if you look at this slide, here you can see more.
We're talking about slide five now, is that correct?
Yes, yes, okay. Sorry.
Just want to make sure we're on the same page.
Yeah, absolutely. If you look at this slide, this is some data on the housing market. And you can see, logically makes sense, that generally mortgage application for purchase, because most Americans need a mortgage to buy a home, tend to lead the housing data. And what you can see is middle of last summer, when rates were on the lows, mortgage application for purchase was clipping along at a pretty brisk rate, around 15% per annum. It's now barely over 4%. That is a function of higher rates, which is what we've had. We've had a tightening, certainly in terms of rates and the dollar, of those financial conditions. And that's going to manifest itself in slower exports. Those have already become a drag again. A couple of quarters ago, they were a positive. Now they're back to being a drag. Overseas earnings, car sales, which we can all see are peaking out. And in this case, housing. So we think this peaking of the cyclical forces, this background tightening of financial conditions, or in an environment where, if you look at the next slide, we're super hyped up, right? Expectations are incredibly hyped up, having been caught completely offside in 2014 with the collapse in oil prices and what that did to the economy. Economists basically, since early 2015, have spent 2 years being behind the growth inflation curve. Now they're finally coming out with forecasts which are in line, and yet they're right at the highs. And I think this just sets you up for a classic disappointment, what we've called this sort of Trump gap, where you get this peaking of the cyclical forces, some drag from a tightening financial conditions, in a backdrop where expectations are very hyped, and we have this gap between now and when hopefully the fiscal infrastructure tax cuts start to hit sometime in Q4.
So if the Trump gap that you're describing is right now, we've kind of run out of the cyclical forces, we've run out of cycle, so to speak, and you see a lull until Donald Trump achieves his goals, that just invites the question, what if Donald Trump meets resistance from Congress and doesn't achieve his goals, and the effort to pass tax reforms at a big fiscal spend goes the way of, you know, this last bill that we thought was going to happen and didn't?
Absolutely. Well, I think, you know, we'd obviously have to, I mean, I think that it's going to take some time to see that. I think, you know, you shouldn't really expect a package out of the House till just before the summer recess. And then the Senate, you know, has Q3 to kind of deal with it. But I, you know, look, if that's the case, Eric, I think we would expect to see obviously materially lower bond yields. And given how far the equity market has run up, I certainly wouldn't want to be long stocks, but it's just not at this case. It's just not my base case. I still think we do get something.
Well, let's go back to the Treasury question then, because the last time we had you on, you were definitely bearish Treasuries, and I think you were advising clients to be short Treasuries. I'm guessing that with your expectations as you've just described them, that changes the picture. So why don't we go on to slide 7?
Yeah, so essentially a few weeks ago now, yields were just above 250. We sent a note to clients and we said, look, now's the time to be out. And just very simply, the risk reward was no longer there. We've seen such dramatic sort of moves in treasuries. If you go back and look at it historically, the rate of the move, which is one of the things we like to look at for a whole bunch of variables, just doesn't get much more extreme than we'd seen. And so it's very simply, from a risk reward perspective, it no longer paid to be short fixed income. So, you know, we'd had a pretty good run as well, because we pretty much caught the low back in July. So yeah, we're just sort of out. And you can trade this if you're aggressive. And I think the signal that we would be looking for is a rolling over of this sort of ISM cycle. As I said, next week, I think it's next week, we get the next PMI, ISM, sorry. I think we could see a 60, but that to me would be a chance to sell treasuries if you want to trade a move. Because as you can see here on this chart on slide 7, pretty much every time that we've seen a big peak in ISM and then a dip, you've seen a rally in the treasury market. I think people, you know, have to remember that there's a positive carry element to treasury. So as soon as you can't, you know, you don't, as soon as you're not short anymore, you really should be long. And, you know, that's the way that that market tends to work.
Okay, hang on, though, because your long-term view, as I've understood it, from a secular standpoint, has been bearish treasuries. So how do you know when it's time to put the short back on? What's the signal that tells you that?
Well, I think we'd be looking for some real progress on the fiscal spending tax cut side from the administration, because that's, to me, is the thing that gives you that next leg up. Don't get me wrong. I mean, I don't think that, you know, I'm not trying to turn into a treasury bull. And I said, you know, very specifically, if you're in that trading mentality, I think this is the time that you could risk being long treasuries. And maybe, you know, we can get a move down to sort of towards the low twos. I mean, it's not a huge trading move given where we are now, but I think you can. I would certainly advise any of your clients that if you've been contemplating fixing your mortgage, the next couple of quarters are probably the ideal time to kind of do it, and particularly as we move into the summer, because I think we do get a slight dip in yields. But I would be looking for that fiscal spend, that accelerative move there in the US to start to give us that next wave of the sell-off.
Eric. Okay. And why don't we move on to the next slide? You're talking about the risk that this presents to reflationary trades.
Yeah, I mean, you know, we, in line with our Treasury sort of call a couple of weeks ago, we had highlighted a number of what we consider very reflationary trades. So you could look at things like XME, the mining shares. And another one, which has been a great trade, which we flagged to clients back in August last year, has been the banks and the relative outperformance of the banks. And they're trying desperately, as is the whole equity market, to sort of hang in here. But really, they've been a function of the yield curve movement. And I think if we were to see a rally in treasuries pushing yields back down into the low twos, this to me becomes quite a dangerous sort of trade. And I think there's a whole bunch of things that you could throw into that same pot, as I said. You know, you could look at XME, you can look at breakevens, you can look at all these pseudo-inflationary hedges. If we end up with a peaking out of this cycle, and it is just the peaking out of the cycle, and a slight disappointment. As I said, I'm not trying to be overly bearish. I just think markets tend to trade momentum. They tend to like to trade speed and acceleration. And if that now is now peaking for the moment, one has to be a lot more cautionary on some of these inflationary plays.
And I assume then that the same time frame and the same events would be when you think those reflationary trades start to come back to life.
Absolutely.
Is when there's
so. Actually
Trump passes something and it's it becomes policy as opposed to just promises.
Yes. Yes.
Okay. Okay. So why don't you walk us through the next couple of slides then in the deck? Tell us what's going on here.
So as I said, we're not trying to be, you know, out and out treasury bulls by any stretch of the imagination. And we just see this as a tradable move. And one of the reasons why we're not becoming structurally bullish on the fixed income market and why we remain highly worried about it we believe it's quite possible that we put in a secular low in last summer, is that we still see a very tight labor market in the United States. So here you've got our model for unemployment, which goes back 36 years, actually. It's got a 0.95 correlation to the unemployment rate. It's worked way, way better than a lot of the Fed models, and it leads by about 4 months. And you can see that it continues to push lower in green versus the actual unemployment rate in white. And what's significant about this, Eric, is we are now below NARU, so the non-inflationary rate of unemployment. And that's important because we believe that we're already in a wage inflationary environment. And once again, if then Trump comes through and starts to spend money, and we push that unemployment rate significantly lower, you are going to get, I think, a rapid increase in wage growth, which isn't really rapid at this stage. It's still relatively moderate. But you can already see what that potentially means for inflation, because higher wages go straight into core inflation. Now, you can see from the model on slide 10, we do have a slight dip, pause, call it what you will, in that cycle. But once again, second half of the year, when once again we'll be looking for signals to try and get short treasuries and short and back into these reflationary trades, you can see that core inflation based upon wages starts to accelerate quite meaningfully.
And I see on slide 11, you're reading my mind here, because when you talk about treasuries, I understand your arguments for U.S. treasuries, but it seems like Europe, you know, the fluff has not blown, or the top has not blown off in Europe yet. So is it bunds? Is it other sovereigns? Where is the shorting opportunity for people who want to play the secular trend in increasing yields?
Well, I think, yeah, exactly. So we've had obviously a big correction in treasuries, and we've had very, very little correction in European fixed income. And we have an ECB, and there's another story out today where they're pushing back against what they think is overinterpretation of the last meeting. I think you have an ECB which has got themselves into a true bind, where in actual fact, if you go through our models, and I was doing this again this morning because I'm just about to go off on a trip to Europe, you can see some absolutely explosive domestic growth stories starting to pick up across a slew of countries. And that is sort of neatly summarized by the chart you can see on slide 12, which shows, you know, solidly accelerating GDP growth. And I think your listeners have to bear in mind that, you know, real trend growth in Europe is probably only 0.5%. It's incredibly, incredibly low, because productivity growth is so incredibly low and the population growth is so incredibly low. And in that environment, if you start growing at 2.5%, you know, and this model suggests sometimes as we move into the second half of the year, we could be growing at almost 3%. That's ripping the wings off it in Europe. You know, and you've got also, if you look on the next slide, you've got very much rising inflation expectations. And, you know, if you go back and you run, say, inflation expectations against the ECB depo rate, what you'll find is you've just, in previous spurts of inflation expectations, the ECB would have hiked. Well, let's not forget, they hiked twice in 2011 and they hiked in 2008. I mean, appallingly timed hikes, but nonetheless, that was the ECB that was. Now it's not run by the Teutonic North, it's run by the flabby South, who want to go easy on inflation, most notably because they're very much concerned, I think, about, and rightly so, about Italy. But the fact of the matter is there is going to come a crunch point where it's going to be increasingly difficult for them to push back against this, you know, barring, shall we say, Marine Le Pen coming through and blowing up the whole euro experiment, it's going to be increasingly difficult for them to push back against this growth inflation story, because they've had no tightening of financial conditions over there, and balance the euro is actually lower, rates haven't changed, the equity market's significantly higher. All of this is just adding more and more and more fuel to what I think is a bubble that essentially Draghi has created. And what I think is quite interesting as well is, for all this rhetoric that he would have us believe, that it's simply base effect. If you start to look at some of these comments we're getting from, you know, something like, if you can see on slide 14, this market Eurozone composite PMI, you can see that there's clear signs of secondary price effects coming through. And if you look what, you know, I've highlighted two things, but two things in particular. So the average price changes for goods and services rose at the steepest rate since 2011. This is what firms are actually charging their customers. So we've gone from rising input costs in terms of base effects from oil and commodities, and now these firms are actually passing these prices on. And what's more, you're actually getting signs of rising wage growth and supply chain pressures. These are not primary sources of inflation. These are definitively second round effects. And this becomes much, much more corrosive. And so this is why we've really switching our focus to Europe and to the relative divergence between yields in the US and in the Eurozone. And that's actually captured again if you look on slide 15.
Let me just ask a question there, because we've had quite a few guests express a view that Europe is in really serious trouble. Of course, the Brexit Article 50 trigger occurred this week. A lot of guests have said that they think it's the beginning of the end, that soon several other countries will exit Europe, the economy will fall apart, they're in big trouble. Obviously, you're expecting European growth to accelerate. So Does that imply a different view about European exit risk contagion, or how do you see this?
Structurally, no. But I do think it would be, you know, one of the things that I often disagree with friends and peers of mine is whenever you get weak data, you have a lot of people that sort of run around and say, oh, my goodness, you know, look, ISM is going to drop below 46. The whole experiment has failed. The world is going to blow up. The equity market is going to implode. My base case has always been that you don't get to the Armageddon scenario with weak data. You actually get to the Armageddon scenario when you actually get strong data. Because in weak data, ISM dropping through 46, European growth failing to materialize, inflation sitting on the lows of 2014, 2015, you can get vast swathes of accommodative central bank policy. They can print, they can do all the other distortive measurements and steps that they've taken, and they can essentially inflate the market. They can do what the Japanese did. They can buy equities. They can do whatever they want, Eric. That's never the end game. You can get a wobble in that scenario, but it's not the end game. The end game for markets, the most dangerous, toxic scenario for markets, comes when actually, when you've got vastly inflated prices and central banks actually need to hike. So imagine a scenario later this year where, let's say, look, obviously, because the French election could be a heart attack, but let's say we have continued deterioration in the Italian economy, which is our base case, but everywhere else in Europe is booming. And inflation pressures are coming through. And the ECB, whether Draghi likes it or not, he is facing a full revolt with everyone in Northern Europe, including the French, because the French economy looks to us like it's absolutely, barring, as I said, Marine Le Pen, about to explode in terms of growth. And Europe's second largest economy growing will have a material impact. But let's say, for instance, that that's what happened. Draghi is actually forced to hike. Then in a bizarre way, because he's created such a bubble in the bond market, as that thing blows, he's actually going to be responsible for sinking Italy. Because if the equity markets go south as that bond market blows, he can't come in with more QE because he has ingrained inflation and they have a singular mandate. So the end game doesn't occur via weakness. It actually occurs via strength.
And that's actually the exact scenario that I've predicted for years, is when we really get to the end game is when you have an inflationary backdrop and suddenly the central bankers' hands are tied and they cannot solve everything just by conjuring more money out of thin air. And so you think that scenario could be coming fairly soon in the next year or so?
Well, I mean, I think, yeah. I mean, I think we're laying, you know, certainly if you get the Trump stimulus come through and we get the ECB continuing to prevaricate over rates, then yes, I fear that that's the end game.
Okay, got it. Let's move on then to slide 15 and relative pricing, where I interrupted you before.
Yeah, no, absolutely. So if you look at, you know, as we said, if we enter this sort of period of of relative disappointment in the US, you know, a sort of a slowing of growth relative to expectations, should we say, not necessarily reality, and this continued acceleration of growth in Europe. The model's already picking this up. If you can look at this red chart here, it's based on relative output. And it tells you that essentially that the rate spread should be between bunds and treasuries should be a lot closer to sort of 150 odd basis points than over 200, which is at the moment. And so that's one of the reasons why we're sort of focusing on Europe, because we think that's where the mispricing has occurred. But that has quite significant consequences for the dollar. And while we remain structural
Before we go on to the dollar, let me just back up to that trade. Where is the trade there? Is it just short bonds? Is it a pairs trade, short bonds, long treasuries?
I personally quite like it to be long treasuries and short bonds as a pair trade, because you've got big positive carry in your favor because you belong the treasury. So I quite like that as a trade. And I think it's a much more manageable trade, Eric, via a spread, because the other outcome, of course, is that spread can close in two ways. We can get the positive way, US growth kind of loses a little bit of oomph, treasuries rally a little bit, and European growth keeps going, and then you get that positive outcome. And of course, you could get the negative outcome where Trump just disintegrates. We you know, the market increasingly moves to price in no fiscal stimulus, and then treasury yields are just going to collapse. Bund yields have got pretty much nowhere to go, and that spread also ends up tightening. So I quite like that as a relative trade.
Okay, great. Let's go back to the dollar then.
So all of this, you know, having been big dollar bulls for a long time, leads us into this much more choppy sort of dollar environment. And I think one of the things that concerns us a little bit, and I think is a definitive risk given ongoing market bearishness towards the euro, is the fact that essentially we have been trading this rate differential. We've been trading this rate differential incredibly, incredibly closely for between bunds and treasuries for quite some time now. And if we're right and that rate differential narrows for whatever reason, the risk is that this thing pops significantly higher, this euro dollar. And, you know, a rate differential of 150 basis points would get you sort of 118. And so I think that that is a risk. And it fits in with, once again, this sort of Trump gap idea that until we see – now, I think it looks very likely that BAT as a tax proposal is probably dead on arrival. But my understanding is there's still this corporate tax repatriation deal is very much part of the plan. And that to me is just as its forebearer, HIA, back in the mid-2000s was incredibly bullish for the dollar. And it's incredibly bullish for all the reasons we discussed back in December, Eric, where you have a world that's already structurally, you know, starved of dollars because the US current account deficit has shrunk. So if you repatriate dollars, which, as I said, still looks to be part of the plan, I think the dollar goes ballistic in 2018. And that could be also occurring just at the same time that the Fed is finally forced to get realistic and hike materially to combat rising wages and core inflation pressures. And that makes 2018 to me look very, very dangerous as an environment. But for the moment, you know, if we get this relative slowdown, euro goes up, dollar comes off a little bit, and once again we're in this sort of choppy transitional pause phase before, dependent on the passage of the administration's plans, a much more inflationary, structurally dollar bullish backdrop in late 2017, early 2018.
Okay, so when we spoke back in December, at that time, you were very bullish on the U.S. dollar, you were very bearish on U.S. treasuries. You said earlier in this interview that you're kind of recommending that your clients sit out a couple of dances on that short U.S. treasury trade. Mm-hmm. Is the same true of the long U.S. dollar trade? Is it time to close that and wait a little bit before getting back into maybe better positioning?
I think certainly what I would call against some of the – well, I mean, it's selective. So if you think that the reflationary trade starts to lose a little bit of momentum, then you start to play things like relative gains. So you play, you want to be short probably the Aussie and the CAD and the Kiwi, but as per this chart here, you might want to be long the euro. So then you switch from things like straight, you know, dollar Aussie trades to euro Aussie trades. So it becomes a, it almost becomes as like a stock picker's environment, to use a sort of common euphemism, as opposed to a straight, clear dollar trade.
Okay. Well, we will definitely look forward to getting you back on the program so that we can get an update as all of these various factors start to work out. And I have to tell you, Julian, you set records on this program in many ways, but one of them that's just most impressive to me, you know, the usual deal here is we give the guest a chance to promote whatever it is that they're selling at the end of the interview. And of course, that advertisement, you know, the listeners don't come to hear the advertisement. They come to hear the content. They have to hear the advertisement. We're getting angry emails, Julian, from people saying, what's wrong with you? When are you going to get Julian Brigden back on the program? He said something about maybe offering something to retail. When are you going to find out what it is? So I know there's one listener, and this gentleman knows exactly who he is because he's been emailing me a lot, who fast-forwarded to the end of the interview because he wants to hear the advertisement for what you're going to do for retail investors. And you're not ready to talk about it, are you?
No, I can't yet. Ladies and gents, it's in the pipeline. Give us another 2 to 3 months. Things have got sort of delayed. It's a lot more complicated than we thought, but there's absolutely something in the hopper, I promise you. I will happily come back along with my co-conspirator, who you know, Eric, but we're not going to mention for the moment, you know, in a couple of months. In the interim, we have finally moved into the 21st century, and we've set up a Twitter account, which I've put on the last slide of the presentation pack. So you can follow us at JulianMI2. So we're on Twitter now. So please feel free to do that. And we will absolutely come back on the show, Eric, when we are ready. And as I said, it's probably 2 to 3 months. It's just been a lot more, you know, in an environment where we're focused on markets 24/7, you know, trying, finding time to build this other product has just taken, you know, a lot of work, but it's coming.
Well, and I'll just add in, because I do know a little bit more than we're at liberty to talk about as to what's going on. The reason it's been delayed, folks, is because it's such a good idea that it is being reevaluated in terms of how to market it to a much larger audience, and I think it's going to be profoundly successful. From our standpoint, as the Macro Voices community, we're just going to turn this into a positive. Now you have committed, Julian. We're going to get you back on the program probably in the next month or two, a little bit sooner than we normally do. And get another update both on how the Trump gap is evolving as well as when you're ready to launch this product that will make some of your research available to the retail component of our audience. But for the institutional component, I want to make sure they're aware it is institutionally priced, but you do offer an excellent advisory service to institutional clients at MI2 Partners. Give us just a quick rundown on what you do there.
So yes, we're building up the team. You know, we've built up the team very steadily now. We have myself, who I sort of mostly work with the models and some of the market stuff, and then we have two other colleagues, partners in the firm, who are ex fund managers, have got between them 55 to 60 years of experience running portfolios for both hedge funds and real money. They are very much focused on market timing, how to express trades, because really, you know, and this will be the same MO that we try and bring to the retail product. I have little interest in pontificating for the sake of pontification, and I don't have a lot of respect for a number of peers of mine, I guess, in the market, because that seems to be what they do. The only thing at the end of the day that matters to all of us is making money, and that is what we endeavor to do, and that's why we built the team that we have. We're not economists, we're strategists, we're ex-market people, that's the whole process at MI2 is to try and help people think structurally about the market. The institutional stuff is is a little bit longer in terms of its outlook, because it takes time. You're influencing a thought process of an institutional investor who often, it's his ability to move quickly is obviously constrained sometimes by the size of his portfolio. So there's much more of that sort of involved, and he can play a wider range of different instruments than retail investors. But we will bring that same MO to the retail product.
Well, we will get you and your partners in this venture back on the program to talk about it as soon as you're ready to launch it. In the meantime, the Twitter handle to follow is at JulianMI2. And Patrick Ceresna and I will be back as Macro Voices continues right here at MacroVoices.com.
Macro Voices is a listener-driven program. Please email requests for specific future interview guests to requests@macrovoices.com. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer them on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. We also welcome your suggestions for how we can improve the program. Now, back to your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna.
What a great interview with Julian. What resonated the most with me was that when he suggested that he is no longer short treasuries and emphasized the positive carry element to the treasuries, suggesting that when you are no longer short anymore, you really should be long. And so what were your thoughts on that interview?
Very similar to yours, actually. I was most taken by the idea of the pairs trade, short German bunds, long treasuries, and the idea that the positive carry you're getting from that long treasury position is going to basically cancel out the negative carry on the short bund position. I love that idea. So I'm particularly attracted to that trade. And as you say, I think Julian just has fantastic insights. I love the way the guy thinks.
Now, last week, we suggested we would continue our conversation on option writing as an asset class, and we were supposed to discuss the short straddles and strangles. But Julian inspired me to share a new income trade idea with our listeners. Now, anyone who's watched my 2017 market forecast knows that I was anticipating a flattening of the yield curve during this rate hike cycle, and I've been fiddling around with these U.S. Treasury bonds since December. So when I heard Julian suggest that there may be an opportunity to trade the bonds higher, I thought it was a great opportunity for us to build an options credit spread on this narrative.
Hang on, I want to interrupt you there because you mentioned your 2017 outlook. Some of our newer listeners may not know where to find that. So bigpicturetrading.com is the place to go for Patrick's 2017 market forecast across all asset classes. In general, though, I love the approach you're taking, Patrick, because we had such great feedback on the credit spreads we did on oil. And I think what I'm getting from our listener emails is that we should probably focus these post-game conversations about options on ideas that related to what was covered in the interview. So I really appreciate your taking that approach. Now, Julian was talking about shorting the bonds and so forth because he advises institutional clients. I'm guessing because you do a lot of retail work that you were probably focused on one of the ETFs such as TLT for this trade.
Yes, you know, while our sophisticated listeners could use, let's say, options on the futures markets, the TLT is the most accessible way for most investors to participate. Now, I'm sure many of our listeners are already familiar with the TLT, but those that are not, it's the iShares 20-year Treasury Bond Exchange Traded Fund. And just for further clarity, because when you are trading bonds, it moves inversely to the yield. So when you hear one of our guests suggesting that yields were going to decline, it means the bonds and the bond ETFs are going to rise in their price.
And just to be clear for our listeners, the outlook that you're anticipating for the TLT is that it should be flat to bullish in price action based on what both you and Julian have predicted about the direction of the underlying bond market.
Right. So like last week when we discussed credit spreads, you would in this situation use a bull put spread to try to profit from this narrative. So at the time we were recording this podcast, those TLT shares were trading very close to the $120.50 level. So one that agrees with this investment theme would feel that there's limited downside risk to these TLT shares. So in this case, with us trading just above that $120 level, one could consider 120 down to 115 put credit spread out to, let's say, July. So for that July expiration credit spread, the spread is currently paying around $2 credit for that $5 spread.
Now, just to be clear about where the value in this trade is, it's really in hedging the risk in the setup. When you hear smart guys like Jeff Gundluck talking about 3% yields coming at some point on the 10-year, it takes a lot of conviction to put a trade like that on with any real size. But when you open it up as a credit spread, you build in a hedge so that in the worst case scenario, if you find out that you're too early to the trade or you just got it wrong or whatever happened, you have hedged your risk and you've got a limited downside if you have to get out.
Exactly. So let's just compare a scenario. So if we have one investor who just, you know, has heard the conversation with or your interview with Julian and was saying that, you know, I'll just buy some shares of the TLT and I'll, let's say, enhance it with some covered calls or something like that. You'd have to outlay $12,000 for every 100 shares you want to buy. Here, we just need to outlay the spread minus the credit, or about $300 for every one contract spread. So obviously, one can leverage this to enhance the returns. But to me, the real appeal lies in the fact that you can have the staying power to stick with the trade, knowing that you have the absolute worst case scenario priced in.
And I can certainly relate to that one. So just to clarify for our listeners what you're talking about, when I got stopped out of my long position in dollar index futures this week, had I hedged not with a stop loss order, but with a put option, I would have been able to ride that as low as it went. And when it moved back up above my stop level, which it has done with gusto since then, I'd be back in the trade and making a profit again, as opposed to whipsawed out in volatile market action. So what you're saying here is, by setting it up with options, you're basically locked in a maximum risk. You don't have to respond and freak out and look at the price going against you and decide whether or not to close your position prematurely. You've already got the risk controls in place when you put the trade on.
No, that's exactly the point I was trying to make. But I also want to make one further observation. So I want to actually compare the income stream that's coming. So if you wanted to compare something like the long stock with that positive carry Julian was referencing, we want to compare that to the option spread trade. So the TLT itself pays monthly distributions that average very close to around 25 cents a month. So an investor playing this reversion trade and, let's say, outlays the full cost of the bonds has the upside potential of the TLT, and for the next 4 months, let's say, is being paid around $1 in distributions or income. But alternatively, with the spread, we've made almost double that income with a much smaller capital outlay that was risk hedged. And so the downside to while you make more income is that you don't have any of the capital gains upside that the person that owns the shares does. Now, I do want to point out that we intentionally opened the spread out of the money, right? So the stock is above 120 and we are opening a 115-120 spread. But if the hang up for the investor is that there is no upside to the spread, I do want to point out that investor could open the credit spread with the short leg being in the money. So an example, with that TLT trading just above 120, you can open, let's say, a 115-125 credit spread. Now, this builds in a synthetic upside, but again, in a very risk-managed way.
Well, again, I really appreciate your focusing the option discussion on implementing some of the ideas that were discussed in our featured interview. I think that's going to be a popular theme with listeners. But once again, we are out of time. So I'm looking forward at some point, whether it's next week or another show, to your discussion of writing short straddles and strangles. And folks, if you want to learn more about this stuff, there's no better place to go than Patrick's website, bigpicturetrading.com. Patrick is in the business of selling trader education. There are course offerings there for options, for macro trading, for technical analysis, and a bunch of other stuff. So you can find that at bigpicturetrading.com. Meanwhile, keep your questions for this program, as well as any requests for topics or interview guests, and send those to requests@macrovoices.com.
Thank you very much, Eric. So anything else that you want to add before we close?
As our regular listeners know all so well, we really, really appreciate your help promoting this program. The more registered users we have, that's the statistic that Patrick uses to recruit these really awesome featured interview guests. So please retweet us, tell your friends, forward your research roundup emails to your friends and colleagues. Use our new player embed so you can put a Macro Voices player on any website in about 5 minutes. And most importantly, please register your free account at macrovoices.com. Only takes a couple of minutes to set up, helps us to recruit better guests. The direct benefit to you is you'll receive our research roundup email, which never contains advertising. It's just a compendium of links to all the cool free stuff that we could find on the internet each week, including the download from the featured interview guest if someone like Julian has given us a chart book as he did this week. So, Patrick, what can they find in this week's research roundup?
Well, in addition to obviously the link to listen to this show, we have the transcript for today's interview with Julian. In addition to that, there's that link for Julian's chart book that accompany this week's interview. Beyond that, we have a link to an article discussing the commercial realities of the Brexit. I actually really enjoyed reading that one. As well, there's a link to a great article written by Michael Hudson titled Wall Street First. You'll find this and so much more in this week's research roundup. So that does it for this week's episode. We appreciate all the feedback and support we get from our listeners and are always looking for suggestions on how we can make the program even better. For those of our listeners that write or blog about the markets, we would love to share your content with our listeners. So send us an email at researchroundup@macrovoices.com or tag it with the MVRR hashtag on Twitter, and we will include it in our weekly distributions. Now, if you have not already, follow our main Twitter account at Macro Voices for all the most recent updates and releases. You can also follow Eric on Twitter at Eric S. Townsend. On behalf of Eric Townsend and myself, thank you for listening, and we'll see you all next week.
That concludes this edition of Macro Voices. Be sure to tune in each week to hear feature interviews with the brightest minds in finance and macroeconomics. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com, the Internet's premier source of online education for traders. Please visit BigPictureTrading.com for more information. Please register your free account at MacroVoices.com. Once registered, you'll receive our free weekly Research Roundup email containing links to supporting documents from our featured guests and the very best free financial content our volunteer research team could find on the internet each week. You'll also gain access to our free listener discussion forums and research library. And the more registered users we have, the more we'll be able to recruit high-profile feature interview guests for future programs. So please register your free account today at macrovoices.com if you haven't already. You can subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes to have Macro Voices automatically delivered to your mobile device each week free of charge. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer your questions on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. Macro Voices is presented for informational and entertainment purposes only. The information presented on Macro Voices should not be construed as investment advice. Always consult a licensed investment professional before making investment decisions. The views and opinions expressed on Macro Voices are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the show's hosts or sponsors. Macro Voices, its producers, sponsors, and hosts Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna shall not be liable for losses resulting from investment decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on Macro Voices. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com and by funding from Fourth Turning Capital Management, LLC. For more information, visit MacroVoices.com.